Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Will I am. You know this guy? Phil Conlon is here.
Good afternoon, Phil.
Just barely. You just came in the door.
Well, I'm here.
This is instant coffee, instant caffeine-free, instant Taylor Report. We're going to be talking to Isaac Saini about Canada-Cuba relations, Canada-U.S. relations. This is a topic we want our listeners to be on top of. I think it's very important. Isaac Saini is going to be speaking Friday evening at the different book lists, 779 Bathurst at 7 p.m. And another event I want to make sure we announce, June 9 at 2 o'clock in Hamilton, Libby Davies is going to be talking about her new book. Many people are interested in the career of Libby Davies. Had her problems with the NDP leadership and a very, very prominent, probably one of the best personalities produced by the NDP, and she's written a book about it. 24 Main Street, June 9, 2 o'clock. That's in Hamilton. That's a Sunday. And I believe we're joined on the line by the man himself, Isaac Saini. Are you there, Isaac?
Yes, I'm here. How are you doing? Sorry, I'm on the bus at the moment as we speak, but I'll be getting off soon.
Okay, we want to keep track of that. If you have any problems, just sure. Let us know. You are going to be talking on Friday night at the different book lists, 7 o'clock, and discussing a topic which has moved to up on the world's agenda. The U.S. seems to have gone from hello Obama to goodbye Trump. Towards Cuba, it's kind of a shock. My impression is that they're sort of changing the terms a bit, and it's quite a perilous, or I suppose it could be a perilous situation. The first phrase I know is Helms-Burton. Why do this new policy of the Trump administration seems to have a reference to Helms-Burton? What is that about?
Well, the Helms-Burton Act was passed in 1996, driven by Senator Jesse Helms and Representative Burton. And basically what it was about trying to fix the Cuba economically, by basically doing a number of things. One was applying U.S. law, making U.S. law applicable in other countries, for example, like Canada. So there's an extraterritorial aim to it where U.S. law must trump domestic law. So in Canada, the idea was that U.S. law would trump Canadian law by imposing U.S. economic sanctions against Cuba and, in a sense, prohibiting Canadian companies from doing business with Cuba. The other point was actually, before this, the U.S. economic war against Cuba, the sanctions against Cuba, were carried on through the Trading with the Enemy Act. So basically, that's how the U.S. president carried it on, right? There was no specific law that specifically, mentioned Cuba. It was used during the Trading with the Enemy Act. What the Helms-Burton Act did was to codify into law actual explicit legislation against Cuba. And what it did is establish the whole idea that, the U.S. should not have relations with Cuba, a whole number of things, as long as, one, Fidel Castro was in government, or Raul Castro was in government, or Cuba maintained its socialist system. And beyond that as well was a couple of things related to Title III and Title IV. Now, Title III basically allowed U.S. Citizens, right? Mm-hmm. U.S. companies that had lost property during the Cuban Revolution, the Cuban government nationalized, that they could then seek legal action against Cuba through a whole variety of compensations, right? By bringing court cases and so forth. And it's important to understand in this context that when Cuba nationalized in the wake of the revolution, a whole series of properties, they nationalized properties from Spain, France, a number of other countries. All of these countries basically worked out compensatory deals with Cuba. So all those things have been settled. When Cuba offered to settle with the U.S. companies, the U.S. government intervened to ensure those settlements wouldn't take place. And also, I think to bear in mind as well, is when the Cubans were actually calculating what the compensation should be. they were using the tax returns that those U.S. companies had submitted to the Batista regime. And those had all been fraudulent.
Yes. By the way, Isaac, I have to ask you, because I heard it, I know there's an echo of a previous experience with Mexico. The President Cardenas of Mexico, when they nationalized Standard Oil, I think it was, he said, we're going to compensate you according to your tax claims.
Yeah, and of course, those guys have been submitting fraudulent tax claims. The same with Cuba, in order not to pay their taxes. I mean, the Batista regime that Fidel Castro's revolutionary movement overthrown was notoriously corrupt and was working hand in glove with all of these companies. And so what happens is that, you know, obviously, these companies said, well, we don't want to use those because those don't really represent the real value. And in a sense, everybody knew we were lying, so we can't use those. So it's extremely bizarre and duplicitous, right? But beyond that, the U.S. government didn't want them to to actually work out any compensatory agreement. And, your viewers should know that under international law, any national government is within its rights to nationalize any property. The only proviso or limitation is that they have to provide prompt and what's called adequate compensation. And the Cubans have negotiated that with, as I said, the British interest, the Spanish interest, the French interest, and any other country whose property has been nationalized.
I have to ask you, and by the way, it is Isaac Saini, and he's going to be talking Friday night at a different book list.
Yeah.
How about Canada? Did they work out something with
Canada? Yes, they worked out with the Canadian companies. Every country worked out what was to their satisfaction, adequate compensation. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important also to understand as well, which is why, you know, this has come back, is that this Title III, which allowed these people to, these U.S. companies or U.S. citizens to launch legal cases, that all of that this was suspended by Clinton and all subsequent U.S. presidents.
Yeah. It was, it was like a loaded gun always laying there to be used.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was sitting there, and they knew that what would happen was this would cause all sorts of, confusion, all sorts of problems with the European Union and other countries that were doing business with Cuba. So the whole point of the Helms-Burton Act was to actually, to cut these links off, but also to basically cause other countries to be extremely concerned or actually fearful of doing any kind of business with Cuba, because they'd be fearful of actually facing lawsuits in the United States. And so because this would cause all sorts of problems with, your European Union allies, for example, every president, and even Trump early on, used to basically suspend Title III, and there's another section, Title IV, which aimed to stop the travel of people and their families who are involved in business in Cuba. The U.S. uses this obscene term called trafficking with stolen property. Mm-hmm. That's sort of really ridiculous term.
Yes.
And what happens is that Title III and Title IV were suspended, but Trump, as we know, in the last couple of months, just recently, he allowed complete freedom for people now to use Title III and Title IV and to begin to launch suits. So one of the curious things is that Carnival Cruises, an American company, is actually facing lawsuits in Dade County, Florida. And one of the funny things is the Carnival cruise companies that were engaged in these businesses with Cuba, these exchanges with Cuba, taking cruises to Cuba, were doing it under authorization of the U.S. government. And suddenly, they're facing suits. So there's a possibility of a whole number of different suits being launched against Cuba. Launched against businesses that are doing business in Cuba. So, for example, Sherritt International, which is a company that has significant investments in Cuba in a whole variety of sectors, could face lawsuits. Anyone, for example, that's running, say your Air Transat, for example, and you're flying into the Cuban airport, or your cruise ship going into the Cuban port, because that's once deemed to be property of U.S. citizens, i.e., people who have now fled who have fled from Cuba now to the United States, they're now U.S. citizens. They can sue anybody. So it's an incredibly broad sweep of the law, incredibly ambiguously written, that can create all sorts of problems. And the goal really is to asphyxiate Cuba, and more importantly, to destroy the example of the Cuban Revolution. Mm-hmm. As we all know, the immediate background to this is the U.S. attempt to overthrow the government of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. Yes. They launched a whole variety of attempts, coup attempts, and they failed. And now, basically, having failed, they can't recognize that they completely misread the situation in Cuba, that they engage in illegitimate activity. So they're looking around to somebody to blame, and one of the people they're blaming is Cuba.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it is a this policy towards also towards Nicaragua. I mean, anybody who had who has taken an anti-imperial position and a defense actually of the Americas against U.S. hegemony seems to be put on the list. And of course, we've had governments. We know we've lost Mr. Lula is in prison in Brazil. This matter, I want to ask you about this aspect of it. You know, you mentioned it creates chaos, but this seems to be what they want, right? They want everyone scared. They want a chaotic situation. Canada itself if finds it, you know, when it talks about relations with the United States from day to day, Freeland and Trudeau don't even seem to be in the loop. They're afraid to say anything because they've had trade relations. You know, they thought they have this new NAFTA thing, and then they find out the next day that Mexico is being threatened, and they don't know how to respond because Mexico is part of the new NAFTA. You've commented on this. I want to know what you think about how Canada appears to be responding to this policy of the U.S. In the past, they were pretty firm, but do you think that they are going to remain firm?
That's the question we're all concerned about. I mean, we're all very concerned about the direction that Trudeau and Freeland has taken in terms of Canadian foreign policy towards Latin America. Canada has played a very frontline role in trying to orchestrate the overthrow of the Nicolas Maduro government, even to the point of basically engaging in direct intervention and going almost, shall we say, lockstep with the U.S. I mean, we have the creation of this, fallacious group, as I can call it, the Lima group of these right-wing governments and so forth. At one point, Freeland identified Cuba as being a problem, perhaps the main problem in why Venezuela government hasn't fallen. And of course, I always like to point out, these are the same people who put forward the narrative that Cuba is somehow some dysfunctional country, yet it's a so-called dysfunctional country that is somehow controlling Venezuela. And it's clear, anyone who has studied Venezuela know that, you know, Cuba is not controlling Venezuela, and Cuba, like any other country, can have relations with any other country at once, like Canada can have relations with any country at once, so can the United States and so on. And Cuba has provided significant amounts of medical and other kinds of support that have been very important in advancing what has been an incredible social project in Venezuela that has brought the disadvantaged, the poor, the immensely, exploited and marginalized population that is overwhelmingly non-white, has actually brought them the kind of services, social services they've never had before. So within this, Canada identified, and so has the U.S., that Cuba is a particular problem. But Freeland has come out, and the Canadian government has come out because of the significant economic interest that Canada has in Cuba, also because hundreds of thousands of Canadians travel to Cuba on a regular basis. In fact, for 8 consecutive years, over 1 million Canadians have traveled to Cuba as tourists, and 40-45% of those tourists are repeat visitors. So there's a strong ties of friendship and solidarity between Canadians and Cubans. And I think what happened was that, you know, the Canadian government has to be aware of this. But there have been a number of things that, unfortunately, have pointed that perhaps Canada is thinking of taking on a U.S.-style policy towards Cuba. One was the drawing down by 50% of the staffing of the Canadian embassy and also the closing of the visa office in the Canadian embassy in Cuba. So now Cubans have to actually apply through Mexico to get visas to come to Canada. So whether you're coming as a student, an academic exchange, cultural exchange, sport exchange, you don't have to go through the Mexican office. This is akin to the current
policy. That goes way back to the 60s.
I mean, one of the things about it is that Canada and Cuba have enjoyed over 70 years of uninterrupted diplomatic relations since 1945. And when the Cuban Revolution triumphed and the United States put pressure on countries throughout Latin America and the Caribbean to break relations with Cuba. Only two nations didn't. One was Mexico, one was Canada. So this runs against the history of those relations, right, which acted sort of as a counterweight against the U.S. attempt to impose its tutelage, its hegemony once again on Cuba. And then this visa office is closed. And when this visa office is closed, it caused significant amount of issues and so forth. And there's been a tremendous response from Canadians themselves who have written to MPs, who have complained and so forth. So I think it was a terrible miscalculation by Trudeau and Freeland in regards to how they thought Canadians would react to this hyper-aggressive policy that Canada seems to want to emulate vis-a-vis the United States against Cuba. We shall see how things unfold. Recently, there was a symposium that I participated in organizing and I participated in on Parliament Hill, where we gathered some leading Cuba specialists as well as some of the major actors in the economic field in Cuba who are Canadian. And there was a lot of concern expressed about this, right, about what's happening in Canadian foreign policy and the fact that Canada has always adopted a policy where they may have disagreements with Cuba, but more importantly, they've attempted to build relations based on equality and mutual respect, understanding that at the end of the day, the Cuban nation is in the hands of the Cuban people, and it's up to the Cuban people to determine which path they should take. Mm-hmm. But of course, what we see unfolding here is Canada openly taking, in some ways, the same policy stance as the United States. And of course, I don't want to take the Canadian policy towards Cuba since the 1960s and our breaking relations and romanticize it and paint it in this rosy colors. There, of course, were times where they sort of were playing like the middleman for the United States. But all that being said, to have the kind of policy that Canada had with Cuba, where diplomatic relations existed, where people engaged in dialogue and discussion, is much better, obviously, than having this kind of hyper-aggressive stance that Freeland and Trudeau seem to want to take towards Cuba. But of course, the response, I think, has been in various diplomatic circles in Canada to be very concerned about the fact that over a long period of time, these relations with Cuba and other Latin American countries have been built up. And all of a sudden, these arrangements, right, that took so long to build, so long to consolidate, have been, tossed into the air, right, destabilized, if not completely evaporated, right? And I think that's one of the dangers, as you pointed out, that we have with someone like Trump, is to generate chaos, is to wreck relations that exist, and to introduce such a level of unpredictability and confusion into how we see world affairs unfolding, that it's very hard for us to get any kind of orientation.
Yeah. No, so we have these shocking things, like the arrest of the Chinese businesswoman on behalf of the Americans for a crime that is not a crime in Canada. And that's a major power, and Canada just does as it's told instead of acting like a sovereign country, kind of worrying. And by the way, Canada's role in the OAS, they weren't always in the OAS, but my impression is that they've become the cat's paw for the U.S.
Well, that is the increasing impression of many people, that's what is actually unfolding. That in perhaps, obviously, the great geopolitical tensions that are emerging in the world. Perhaps we may use the word great power conflicts. I don't know if people have often used the word inter-imperialist contradictions, that a certain section of the Canadian ruling class, a significant section, has decided that the United States is the is the band or the bandwagon that they shall tie themselves to, whose coattails they shall ride.
The Lima Group is like a faction. It could destroy the OAS if it keeps up.
Yeah, but also what's happened is obviously many of people in the Lima Group also know that if intervention takes place, if the U.S., for example, were to militarily intervene in Venezuela, many people thought that was on the agenda. In fact, that's what Guaido was calling for, right, when his coup failed, the fiasco. After fiasco has basically demonstrated that he, in a sense, is sort of like an inept, right, and blunt weapon. But if the U.S. did intervene, what would be the consequences for Latin America? And in fact, could it lead to social explosion? So you see even Bolsonaro's, the military in Venezuela, the Bolsonaro's right-wing regime, has stepped back, okay, from this kind of hyper-aggressiveness, because they know at the end of the day, any sort of U.S. military aggression in Latin America could have untold and unintended consequences, okay, that could be deleterious to them. So this Lima group was formed, and Freeland played a central role in bringing it together and forming it. But it seems now to, in a sense, have not only has been discredited, right, as people realize they have to return, right? Mm-hmm. At least watch the return to the old arrangement. I'm not saying that's going to happen. Everything seems to be up in the air. You never know what's going to take place. I always like to point out that all the Second World War arrangements that people used to refer to as the Bretton Woods arrangements that came out after the Second World War, Bretton Woods meaning that that town, that area in where people met in New Hampshire, right, in 1944, when the people began to be talking about the post-Second World War order and all these institutions like the IMF, the World Bank, and what you have, WTO came out of that, or the GATT, which then became WTO came out of all of that, that all of those arrangements, right, that provided a point of reference, even though they were oppressive and imperialist arrangements, we can argue, okay, all of those have been thrown thrown into the dustbin, and what we live in is an incredible period of uncertainty with international law, international principles, fundamental norms of diplomatic practice are violated on a daily basis, and, you know, Trump himself seems to want to do that. But what's also seems to be his favorite mode of action. But what I think is also important to bear in mind is people like John Bolton and Elliot Abrams and so forth, who have come forward and have in a sense been directing U.S. foreign policy. These are people who are, one, Cold War warriors who basically are incredibly vindictive, and want to basically try and what. Ensure that the defeats they suffered, the fact that they weren't able to crush the Cuban Revolution, is something they can now accomplish. That I think that's one of the chief goals. But it's also part and parcel, I think, of the project for the new American century, with the idea of how do you entrench U.S. hegemony, right? How do you use the assets that the U.S. have, which is the military and the overweening might, to ensure that the United States remains the dominant imperial power on the planet? And this, of course, poses all sorts of dangers for the world, the danger of war, the ecological disaster we seem to be facing, among other things, when you look at the social and political problems,
Isaac,
that are emerging.
On that point, I mean, there's different ways to interpret the rise of Mr. Bolton and Abrams, but one interpretation could be that the U.S. is, in a way, more desperate. It isn't as strong as it was. It seems because all this bluster bragging about violating international law and ignoring the United Nations, that's the behavior of a frightened state almost.
Well, some people have argued that, and that's one of the positions that people take, that in a sense, you know, as the U.S. begins to decline as an economic power on the world scale, like its share of the world economy, whether you do it in GDP or other ways, continues to shrink, that, you know, all it has is its military might, its overweening military might, and the hundreds of military bases it has around the world. And, of course, as China rises, and whatever one thinks of the nature of the society in China, there's a whole debate. Is it socialist? Is it imperialist capitalist? There's all these debates unfold. But it represents a very fundamental challenge to U.S. imperialism. And in fact, various papers and position documents that have come out of the Pentagon and as well as other think tanks have always said, pointed out that China is the major threat to the United States, and therefore, there's what was called the pivot to Asia, which happened under Obama and then has been strengthened under the Pentagon, that China must somehow be surrounded by military bases and neutralized, if not brought under U.S. control. So some people argue, yes, this is, you know, a failing imperial power that's seeking desperately to reimpose its hegemony or its dominance in the world. The problem is, whether that's true or not, is what they're carrying on now, whether it's plotting wars against Iran, as I said, whether it's basically circling China and challenging China, leading possibly to an almost inevitable collision. What it means for the world's people is the prospect, right? The portent of something that is horrific, disaster facing humanity.
Yes. We're speaking to Isaac Saini. Isaac is going to be speaking Friday evening at 7 o'clock at the different book list, 779 Bathurst Street. That's Friday the 7th. And Isaac is with the Canadian Network on Cuba. Very good site, by the way, Canadian Network on Cuba.ca. And many of these subjects that we're speaking with Isaac about today are excellent pieces available at that site.
Yeah, and I'd like to point out, too, we'll also have one of the Cuban consuls who will also be speaking with me on the panel, and also we're going to be joined by Sikaya Thomas from the Global African Congress. I mean, all of these issues, right, are so interconnected and so global that, you know, in a sense, you know, they all concern everyone, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what's going on in Venezuela is not just simply a concern for Venezuelans or for Latin Americans. It's a concern for all people on a world scale.
Yes.
We're living in very, very dangerous times. And I think the deterioration we've seen socially, politically, the rise of neo-Nazism and fascism, and also the ecological catastrophe that faces us, I think we're all incredibly surprised by how quickly all of this stuff has developed.
Yeah, there's one element involving the broader culture, one that probably our listeners haven't heard a lot about, but is I'd like your thoughts about. You know, we've grown in North America very fond of people who follow baseball, are very impressed with all the Cuban players who play now in the major leagues. However, Trump has thrown a monkey wrench into that as well by changing their status.
Mm-hmm.
The new position was, as I understood it, was that they Cuban ball player could sign to play in the American major leagues, and of course maintain his status, citizen, et cetera, and simply enter, play, go home.
Yeah.
But now my understanding is that's off, and they're put in a situation where they're going to have to defect, leave Cuba to play. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Cuba had come into agreements, for example, with the Japanese League, right? So where, you know, Cubans could engage in these things, could engage and play in Japanese League, and they could live in Cuba, and, you know, and of course, they, you know, they get their salaries. I mean, those agreements that exist for other countries as well. So with the United States, the only way that Cubans could play in the United States was basically if they defect because of U.S. economic sanctions, right, and U.S. policy towards Cuba. So this basically is aimed at creating a drain of Cuban baseball talent, as always. It's basically against destroying the idea of normalizing relations between Cuba and the United States. You know, when on December the on December the 14th, 2017, when Obama, you know, and Raul Castro jointly announced the opening of the new, of the embassies in Washington and in Havana, and when, of course, Obama visited Cuba, you know, the U.S. goal of undermining the Cuban Revolution did not change, but it was adopting a different tact. It was acknowledging that the hyper-aggressive policy that they had pursued for over five decades had failed, and now they're going to pursue a different policy, right? And, you know, and of course, while this posed new challenges to Cuba, the Cubans were really welcome, because now it had basically been a victory for Cuba. The United States had seemed to be abandoning a policy without Cuba having to budge one iota on any of its principles. And Trump has obviously reversed that. And he's basically attempted to perhaps launch the most aggressive attacks on Cuba, perhaps since, you know, when we can go back to perhaps the early 60s when we had the Bay of Pigs invasion and then Operation Mongoose attempts to assassinate a whole series of Cuban leaders and sabotage the economy. And we can also look what happened under the Reagan administration. This is one of the worst periods of U.S.-Cuba relations.
By the way, I'm glad you raised the name of Reagan, because as you're speaking, I'm hearing Reagan talk in my head, because I remember very well when they said, what is it when he was supplying weapons and money to the Contras in Nicaragua to destroy the Nicaraguan revolution? They said to Reagan, what is it you want from them? And he says, I want them to say uncle. That's what Trump is.
That's what Trump is. I mean, there's this whole idea that the United States...
They can't be equal. We can't sign an agreement where they have respect. They have to say uncle.
Uncle, yeah. No, and I think that's one of the things. Cuba has refused to say uncle. Cuba has, you know, I think an important point there, and people have all these arguments about the pink tide in Latin America, right? You know, did it really bring about fundamental socioeconomic change? There's all these debates about Venezuela, Bolivia, and so forth. The important point is these countries were beginning to, were asserting their independence, and that's unacceptable to U.S. imperialism. And that's why they have the articulation of the Monroe Doctrine and Manifest Destiny. And you have Trump very openly reassert still think that the Monroe Doctrine, which is the U.S. right to intervene in Latin America anytime it wishes, and the Manifest Destiny, which is the idea that the U.S. is the superior nation that will bring, democracy, quote-unquote, and bring prosperity and bring civilization, right, to Latin America, that becomes a justification. I mean, Simon Bolivar used to say that the United States seems to be... the United States definitely seems to be to plague Latin America, with its good wishes, right?
Okay, yes.
And so something similar to that fact.
And we come here as your friend, and we're going to stay.
And we're going to stay, yeah.
And we're going to live in your house.
Yeah, there's obviously massive economic exploitation. Yeah. We all know the litany of what that means in terms of the deleterious impact on Latin Americans. So I think your point is quite correct. It's like when you look at Cuba, they're stunned. They haven't been able to take this heroic people and make them bow to the U.S. dictator.
That's right. I don't think it's going to happen either. Lastly, Isaac, I know we're taking a lot of your time, but I want to get your thoughts about the election in Mexico. A leader who seems to be asserting once again Mexico's independence, as they have for a long, long time. He invited Maduro to come for his inauguration, and he invited, by the way, invited Jeremy Corbyn too. But what's your assessment of Mexico at this time and their role here?
Well, I mean, the point is, I'm not a specialist on Mexico's politics or history, but I would say one thing is that they refused, and they are a major player in Latin America. They refused to recognize Guaido, and basically they continue to recognize Maduro as a legitimate president of Venezuela. And of course, with Trump's attacks on Mexico, the attacks on immigrants, the attacks on Mexican character, the attacks on the Mexican people, I mean, even this threat of tariffs and so forth, I think has demonstrated to many Latin Americans the necessity of at least asserting some nominal form of independence. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll see how this unfolds.
Yeah.
I think there's a significant concern that at the end of the day, right, this kind of hyper-aggressive policy by the United States, even to those regimes that we would not consider progressive in Latin America, they can see that at the end of the day, this could lead to their rule as well.
Yes. Well, Isaac Saini, it's great to talk to you. We look forward to seeing you at 779 Bathurst Street, Friday, 7 o'clock. You and the Cuban Consul General will be there as well. It should be a great evening. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.